Welcome to Common Ground YYC on Livewire Calgary.
Reviendra à la ville de Calgary. Calgary! Here come the
flames! Champions! Today, Calgary is a different place than it was yesterday.
And welcome to episode 2. I'm your host, Josh White. Well, first off, thanks to everyone who listened to episode 1. I thought the reception to first episode was great. I was very encouraged by that. And thanks to everyone who also provided some very constructive and very helpful feedback on the show. And so I'll work hard to incorporate all that feedback and try and make the show hopefully even better. This episode's guest is Jason Markusoff. Jason is the Alberta correspondent for Maclean's. He's been with the National Magazine since 2015, and before then he covered City Hall and Urban Affairs for Calgary Herald for 7 years. He's won numerous national journalism awards for his work, was named Top 40 Under 40 by Avenue Magazine, and Best of Calgary voters picked him as Best Journalist for 2 years in a row. I was really keen to have Jason on the program and get his perspective on a whole bunch of things. He's someone I respect a lot as a journalist and thought he could lend a lot of interesting perspective to some of the major issues going on in our city. And I think he did that here. You'll hear a little bit about Jason's history in journalism. You'll hear how he approaches covering Calgary and Alberta, first at the Herald and now at Maclean's. We dive also right into the Olympic Games conversation and his thoughts on the hosting plan. And you'll also definitely want to hear about his opinion on which side he thinks will win the plebiscite. He has an interesting perspective on that. We also touched on other hot buttons, such as the arena issue. He had lots of thoughts on Mayor Nenshi's mayoralty from his perspective, reporting him. We also covered one of Jason's more acclaimed stories on the national stage as well, which was focused on the early wave of border crossings from asylum seekers. So I think it's a very interesting conversation, and I hope you enjoy. And now, Jason Markusoff. All right. Welcome, Jason Markusoff from Maclean's Magazine.
We'll see how long I stay on this side of the microphone. This may turn the tables, who knows?
You know, when I think of the stereotype of the hardworking, ink-stained journalist, I think of you, Jason. You know, for those who don't know, I used to work in the mayor's office. I used to be kind of on the other side of things, having stuff we were doing being reported by you. So it's interesting being on this side of the table, interviewing you in this context. It's a little different.
We encountered each other earlier than that, in a virtual sense at least, when you were on the skyscraper message board,
yeah,
talking about urban design and skyscrapers and buildings and stuff. And that was actually a daily visit before you were on the mayor's office. I would look at that. I would actually scalp that for news and information and context,
yeah,
on a near daily basis. And so when I heard that Josh White was going to the mayor's office, I'm like, the guy from the skyscraper page? That's a pretty good hire. So you had built-in respect for me from the day you started in the mayor's office.
Well, now you've outed me as the supreme nerd that I am online. But
Is that Nerd Fest still going?
It's Nerd City. It's Nerdville.
It still exists in this age of Twitter and social media and Snapchat and Slack. That thing still exists, really?
That thing still exists. That conversation has migrated to different forms, but it's the same 24 nerds that's been there the whole time. Anyways, can you tell us a little bit about how you arrived where you are as a journalist? You grew up in Hamilton. How did you end up going into journalism?
I started getting interested in journalism because I liked writing in English. I loved writing short stories, poetry. I started at my school's literary anthology, and I realized that you can't make money. You can't make a living as a novelist or poet. I wound up dating somebody who did not like me repeating that anecdote because she was in that field. But so I went into journalism. And I realized how well that meshed with my interest in politics and current affairs and news. And I became a big news junkie. After I graduated, I had a 4-month internship at the Edmonton Journal, thinking I would go out there. I'd never been out west, and do my 4 months, show my glory and my proof of my goodness to the big papers in Ontario, like the Globe and Mail or the Toronto Star. But I wound up staying at the Edmonton Journal. I started out the week before the Mad Cow Crisis, and I latched onto that story, which seemed like a natural fit for a Jewish, then vegetarian from suburban Ontario. I just sunk my teeth in, pun not intended, into that story, and which was a huge story at the time in Alberta in early 2000s. And from there, I went to become a legislature reporter and in Edmonton at the Edmonton Journal for a bunch of years. And then 5 years on, 2008, after Ed Stelmach was getting 4 more years at the legislature, not the most exciting guy to cover, I started looking south. I wanted to see if the Herald was interested, and they were interested in hiring me. They asked, I was talking to them, I was a pretty senior reporter at the Edmonton Journal. If I would come down to the Herald, I'd want a beat. And in those conversations, there are sometimes those places where you're not sure what you say aloud and what you say in your head, you can't remember. I'm not sure about how far this went in external dialogue, but I was saying, I'm going to want a good beat, but nothing lame like City Hall. I think I said that part to myself. Because at the time, I thought that City Hall was a really boring beat, that it was, just covering drone-on meetings. But when I got to the Herald and started writing about urban issues more largely before I was covering City Hall, I realized that it's not about the meetings. It's an amazing beat. You get to write about the transit that's good or bad in your city. You get to write about why your neighborhoods connect or don't connect well to each other, why they don't function well, what your city looks like, what your city feels like. Those are fundamental things that have to do with your city. I mean, there were times where I would just bike by something on my way to work and think, what's that? Why is there a fancy condo tower going up next to a bottle depot? Like, let's talk about the urban development dimensions of that. And I got to write about that. I got to write about not just the city, what was happening at City Hall, but what wasn't happening at City Hall, what was happening in the city. I really tried not to call myself a City Hall reporter. My title, as I styled it myself, was urban affairs writer or civic affairs writer, talking about what's happening in the city, not at City Hall.
Yeah, and for the very same reasons, I think civic politicians and civically engaged people are attracted to the municipal level is the same reason I think you thrived, because you had that intellectual curiosity about the place that we live in. And so many of the decisions that happen at the local level are the things that touch us most on a day-to-day basis. Like you said, the services that are provided, the development that's happening. And I think you did a really good job of capturing that at your time there. I have very vivid memories of being in the office at the time you were reporting. And everyone always knew you were digging. Everyone always knew you were working really, really hard. You were always using all the tools at your disposal, such as freedom of information requests, to gather it. And my feeling at the time was there was always a really healthy respect for your work ethic and your digging into all the issues. And you had a very palpable sense that you really couldn't get away with something. Not that you were trying, but if there was something going on, we knew you would be able to find it. And that created a very interesting dynamic, I felt, and it wasn't a fear, but it was a very healthy respect. And I feel like that's sort of the essence of what a journalist on your side needs to have to do your job effectively.
That is articulate flattery. Thank you very much. A couple of points I would make on that. One is that in this age where I'm tweeting about stuff and the city's putting out press releases to the general public on a rapid basis, it's not worthwhile for my stories in the Herald or what I put out in any media to just say, here's what happened yesterday.
Yeah.
By the time you're looking at the newspaper, a lot of people already know that. At least the readers you're really interested in reaching, the ones who are very committed. People are consuming stuff on a nearly immediate basis. So I knew that I needed to provide something they weren't getting in the nightly newscast or in my tweets to the paper. So I tried to do enterprise stuff. I tried to figure out and find what wasn't being discussed or what was behind what the decisions that were being made or what the consequences are. Like, not, it's not about that the counselors voted 8-7 on this contentious issue. It's what does that actually mean? What are the consequences for that? What does that say about how council thinks? What does that say about how people in Calgary would live? The other part of it is that I would often get this at the provincial or federal levels. When I was covering provincial politics, people would ask me, so what side are you on? Are you Tory? Are you NDP? Are you Liberal? And my answer to that was always, look, sometimes all of you make me slap my forehead. Sometimes all of you make me say, that was a good idea. That was an interesting thing. That's a really interesting point. I'd like to explore that further. You talk about respect. I really tried to respect the institution, respect the offices. These are civil servants and elected officials who, almost as a rule, there are some exceptions, are in this for really good reasons and are trying to do good for their citizenry. And I remember there were some cases where, I think it was Peter DeMong in a couple of budget hearings, would make really good suggestions, not grandstanding, not just talking to be heard or saying something goofy or outrageous to get some positive press or some sensational press. But he asked honestly genuine questions and proposed genuine savings or amendments to the budget. And I had to shake his hand afterwards. I'm like, that's, I watched this stuff and so much of this political stuff is theater. You provided something substantial, and I admire that. I really respect that.
So following your turn at City Hall, you now move to Maclean's Magazine. So you're a national correspondent writing primarily about Alberta. So you're an Ontarian that's come to Alberta. You've covered Edmonton. You've covered Calgary in depth. I'm curious how your job has changed in terms of writing for a magazine, for one, about, Alberta issues, but also national issues, and how you feel has it changed your view on Calgary's or Alberta's place in Canada in terms of trying to relay that story on a national scale as opposed to a local audience?
I think I always sort of had that explain it to the country feel, because I would have friends in Ontario back home. And they would come out and ask me, so what's Nenshi like? And I had to explain Nenshi to them, without them knowing it, with them knowing very, very little. So I want to give them the broad overview, but I also want to give them something specific, something I can actually draw. He's not this glorious, philosopher king thing that sometimes people in Toronto will think or the national media does. He has that aspect to him. We sometimes lose the fact that he has some of those exceptional qualities and captivating public speakerdom, because we get lost in the daily minutiae of him. So I think that it helped me both explain him with a local context and also remove the local context, step back and think, well, hold on a second, how are people relating to him? One of the best things I did was early on, I covered Nenshi's first trip to Toronto. The Herald back then sent me out there, and I got a sense of how people responded to him. That was in the days of Mayor Rob Ford, so it was very, very compare and contrast for Torontonians and Calgarians alike. But it has been a major shift for me to move to Maclean's for a number of reasons. I'm writing fewer stories. I used to write 2 to 3 stories a day on a regular basis, and has more just following exactly what's happening at City Hall. So I was writing less often. I was writing longer pieces. I write pieces that are regularly, I write 2,000 word, the short stories I write now are 800 words more or less, whereas 100 word briefs were common for me. I can't just, even more so than before, I can't just write about what happened. People really want the context. They want the why. They want analysis. I am sort of a columnist, an analyst, pundit, if you will, although I find that word obnoxious.
What precipitated that move? Is it sort of the reflection of where you think media is going in Canada? Being from the inside, what's your take in terms of how things are shifting?
Oh, things are shifting in so many substantial ways. I was seeing somebody reminisce about how big a newspaper staff was back in the heyday. And I also think about how big the classified ad section was back in the heyday. And there are probably some listeners who were too young to know what a classified section was. This large chunk of personal ads in the newspaper. The whole model has shifted completely. And McLean's is not immune to that. We used to have a thick selection of advertising in what was a weekly magazine. Now we're a monthly magazine with number of pages of ads, but that economy has completely shifted. So it's made newsrooms smaller. Where I am at McLean's now, I'm in a bit of a privileged position where I get to pick my spots. I don't have to worry about making sure I cover the whole city or the whole country or all of Alberta. People aren't looking for what happened. People are looking for why something happened or the context or interesting aspects of a story that I can zoom in on. So I'll do that sometimes. Like sometimes maybe it's because I miss it. Maybe it's because I'm still personally engaged with City Hall. I've covered City Hall a fair bit, probably more than McLean's journalist or national correspondent should. It's because I like telling those stories. I once came back to cover Secondary Suites, my old favorite when I was at the Herald, but in a zoomed out version to just explain to the country how screwed up Calgary's process of picking who gets basement suites and who doesn't was. And it was kind of a joy to explain how screwed up that was to the national audience after explaining how screwed it up it was to a local audience.
Yeah, I imagine that must have been somewhat cathartic after having dealt with it on the local level.
Well, and it was fun.
Every day.
And it was fun to be able to have a bit more license to opine and draw conclusions, where I could sort of find subtle ways to hint and point out that this was an embarrassment for Calgary. In McLean's, I could just say, this is a national shame what Calgary's doing. I had more liberty and encouragement to say that. One of the first pieces I wrote for McLean's, my editor was going through it, and she said, you know, this is a good piece, well-written, but it's mostly just recitation of facts. Like, this needs more Jason in it. And I was like, holy crap. For all these years, I've been trying to strip the Jason out of my pieces. You want more Jason? I'll see what I can do.
I'm home, I think.
Exactly.
All right, let's turn to some local issues, some local hot buttons. One of the biggest local hot buttons right now is the Olympic Games. So in your most recent McLean's article, you wrote about the bid, the state of it, some of the council decisions that have been coming down. And we are heading towards a November 13th plebiscite. Calgary's been trying to undertake this bid under the rubric of all the changes the IOC is doing. And you characterize the bid as a we might as well bid. Take us into your thoughts around that point of view.
It starts with me thinking about what Calgary got or remembers fondly out of 1988 and what Vancouver more recently got out of the 2010 Olympics. There was a study I referred to in the piece about the post-games impact in 2010 in Vancouver. And they say, well, tourism actually didn't get that much of a lift. International image, likewise. I mean, what Vancouver's best impacts were out of the Olympics, best benefits, were some of the supporting infrastructure that they got. They got a Vancouver Convention Center, this gorgeous new one along the water, as their international media center. They got a twinned highway to Whistler, the Sea to Sky Highway. They got the Canada Line, the first rail link in Canada to the airport. Those are all things Calgary has could use. I mean, we don't really need a better major highway to the mountains, I guess, but we certainly could use, we talk about a lot, a link to the airport. We talked about better convention space for a while. There are some major things Calgary needs new that we aren't getting with this bid. This bid is built on an idea that we can reuse a lot of our facilities and even some of our older, shabbier facilities that we frankly want. People have been talking about for a while about tearing down and building anew, like McMahon Stadium, the Saddle Dome, the Big Four building, which is a complete shambles. It's not yeah, shambles, but it's long been on the to-demolish list for the Stampede. How about reusing those facilities rather than building things new, rather than giving Calgary a legacy of new buildings, new projects, adding anything transit-wise or transportation-wise to our city? And the argument that some civic leaders, including Nenshi, are making is, well, we have to refurbish the Oval and the bobsled track and some of the smaller arenas anyway. Now we're just going to leverage money from the provincial and federal governments to do so. So that's why I call it the May as Well Olympics. And I don't see that as a compelling argument to put on a major event that includes a lot of major expenditures that we're not going to get anything from, like the security, which is like $600 million or so. That's just police overtime and military and RCMP and security intelligence money that gets spent. And I guess we have some economic benefits of them staying in hotels and eating at restaurants. And if we think back to 88, we got great things out of that. We got the Saddle Dome, we got Nikisco, we got COP, we got the Olympic Oval, all things they want to reuse now. And we also got that great touchy-feely energy and image. We were on the world stage because of the 88 Olympics, or so they said. Okay, we're a city twice the size back then. Our population has remarkably doubled since 88. I don't know how much world stage year we're going to get with the next Olympics.
It's actually very interesting to watch because you're starting to get this generation of repeat hosts. Paris is a former host, but LA is an even better example. There's an example where you have a bid city recycling virtually everything and almost building nothing new. But the difference being that the revenue side of the Summer Games, it's about the same cost as what they're projecting for the Calgary Games, but the revenue is about double. So there's very little government money going in. I think the situation you have right now in Calgary is you have an effort to have the quote-unquote budget games, but they're still costing a lot of money, and there's not quite enough, at least my impression of some of the initial reaction from some of the bid details is there's not quite enough for citizens to sink their teeth into in terms of those tangible things. And it was actually very interesting to see immediately following that debate, the discussion started to turn to, well, maybe this is the opportunity to get an arena. I could support it with an arena included, but right now there's not just enough stuff. So you have this sort of double-edged sword between still a high cost, but not getting a lot. What do you think the path forward is for the bid committee and the supporters of the Olympics to square that circle?
I mean, that's a really interesting challenge that they face. It's sort of the paradox at the heart of this.
Yeah.
The more stuff they build, the more stuff people get out of the Olympics, the more likely this is to win widespread support. The problem with that is that also increases the cost for the provincial and federal governments, both of which are in deficit situation right now and may not be willing to give the world to Calgary, especially when there's already a 2026 World Cup of Soccer going on in Canada, in Toronto, Montreal, and Edmonton. So Alberta's already getting some international sporting money and security funding, no matter what. But I kind of think that that's moot, because I have a good feeling they're gonna win the plebiscite in November.
Okay. Why do you think that?
Because the plebiscite is going to come down to who comes out to vote. There is not a whole lot of publicity around it just yet. I mean, it's 2 months away. We're talking at this point. Things could shift. So standalone plebiscites tend to get very, very low turnout. You know, Calgary elections, civic elections get maybe half the people out in a good time. They've gotten much lower in the past. Only people who are going to care about this are going to come out to vote are people who really care about the Olympics one way or another. There will be some people who just vote automatically and they'll take it every chance to express their democratic franchise. But do people care enough to get off their keisters to go vote? No. Some people will. There will be some passionate people who will. But I think there'll be more people who are going to be impassioned enough to say, yeah, I remember 88 and that was great, and we can give our city the warm fuzzies again. We can tell our great story. We can refurbish our sports legacy facilities. And there'll be some people who think we're going to get a whole bunch of new stuff. I've heard that out there. And I think some of my journalism is trying to disabuse people of that notion that we're going to get stuff. This is not the Gestapo Olympics. This is the recycled Olympics. The other major factor as to why I think it's going to be a yes result in the plebiscite, and I think a pretty healthy one, is the asymmetric war being fought. There's a pretty shoestring no side, no campaign, a very small grassroots group of people that I'd barely ever heard of. On the yes side is a bunch of people who've been active in politics before. The business community is getting involved. The development community, the arts community is trying to get into it. And you have this BidCo that's well-funded. We're going to be promoting their vision and wanting to see it through. So the amount of people who are going to be cheering on the yes side and probably advertising for it, I'm sure there'll be a big mass media marketing campaign that they produce, is going to completely overwhelm the no, any small no side. It'll be a bunch of people I've barely heard of and Rick Bell from The Sun.
That sort of contrasts against what I thought was interesting during the, at least the exploration process, was there was this split between the, well, let's just look at city council. The councillors that were willing to speak up about the Olympics were almost always the most ardent no side. And there didn't seem to be a lot of overt championing from the yes side. Even the mayor has sort of stepped back and said, I have to be somewhat neutral. What do you make of that dynamic there? But also the dynamic of, you know, there seems to be, people have called sort of the allies in this strange bedfellows. It's sort of the furthest left flank of council, represented by the likes of Drew Farrell, and, you know, the quote unquote furthest right on the political spectrum, you know, the likes of Sean Chu that have been most opposed to that. What do you make of that dynamic on city council?
It's been interesting to watch. It's the people who have ardent firm beliefs, either that the Olympics are a silly place to spend money that could be used for other things like arts, pedestrian safety, and the people who just say, no, let's not spend any money on anything. This is a too fancy an event. It's funny how that's happening. I mean, it's beyond Drew Farrell. There's not much of the quote unquote left of city council opposed to this. Woolley is going along. Karai is going along. But you're right. In that middle, that large middle in council, nobody is championing it. I think people don't want to be seen as extravagant. They don't want to be seen as foolhardy with the public purse. They want to either, if it's a successful project, they want to be on, then they'll be champions. They'll get to it once it's a successful project. But they don't, nobody really wants to be, especially of the people who are not fighting this, on the wrong side of history on this one. They don't want to be on the wrong side of the plebiscite vote. Even Nenshi, and knowing what I know about Nenshi, he loves the Olympics. When his predecessor, Bron Kanye, announced in 2010 that he wasn't going to be running, where was Nenshi? He was at the Vancouver 2010 Olympics on his own dime. He went to the London Olympics because he wanted to. He's an Olympics junkie, and he believes in that, in the way that a project like this, a big event like this, can build up a city's identity, bring economic development. He likes those soft infrastructure, soft service things more than, say, the hard, the big edifices. He doesn't necessarily need a major new NHL arena to build our city or a convention center. He likes the idea of events, community spirit helping, libraries helping build our city. This is a thing that, you know, that he wants to be championing on one side, but he also has this odd political caution where he doesn't want to be pushing hard against something that the public doesn't want. He has this very opportunistic populism to him.
Yeah, and just speaking of the Olympics, like I think the draw to it for him and other people is the stuff is harder to quantify. And I think that's part of the challenge in selling this Olympics has been, like you said, it's not about the enormous amount of infrastructure or hard things we have, but people have this intuitive sense of what it did for the city of Calgary in 1988. Having grown up here, it was just an enormous presence in the city and the identity of the city. And I think people are wondering in the 21st century whether there's value to sort of re-upping that central piece of our identity civically and figure out how we can leverage sort of those global eyes on us for for a 2-week period of time. Like, how do you, it's not necessarily easy to quantify something like, you know, global attention, but what can that do for our brand as a city? And I think the mayor is definitely attracted to those types of arguments and those types of things, as is a lot of the supporters.
But I just feel like you can't go to that same well again to get much. I mean, I was looking back at some of the, you know, Calgary in 88 was still seen as a very small Canadian city, definitely in the lower tier of cities. Since then, like I said, I couldn't believe this when I saw this yesterday in researching. The population has literally doubled. The city of Calgary population from 650,000 to 1.3 million now in 30 years. That is astonishing. The oil boom put us on the map in a way, and Nenshi in some ways put us on the map in a way that a 2-week event can only do so much of. I just don't know what sort of a benefit or uplift we're going to get from the second round. I think that we'll maybe be able to tell the story to ourselves better, but what does that mean, and at what cost? I mean, we can do a lot of other things to rebrand our city. I mean, I think Calgary, you know, if we're convinced that we're in a post-oil period, that we're not getting the boom back, we need to do something more than just hosting a major event that will bring in some hotel and restaurant business and some cultural attention briefly to do it. I mean, do we have any great long-term arts and cultural legacy from the 88 Olympics? I'm not sure. Do we have, you know, what did our identity bring from that? I mean, it was still quite a while before we had an economic boom in the city after the Olympics. And the other major thing that we have to think of as we go toward that vote is, okay, so now we're sort of in a post-recession funk still. We're still in a bit of, if not economic doldrums, then certainly spiritual doldrums in Calgary. What's 8 years from now going to bring? 8 years ago, we were exuberant and booming in one of our many boom periods. We were, you know, oil was very healthy and our economy was booming and towers were going up like mad. 8 years from now, who the hell knows what's going to happen in Calgary? Who the hell knows? It's foolhardy to think that we know that the city of Calgary 8 years from now is going to feel, you know, emotionally, economically, spiritually, like the city of today.
So one of those sort of harder infrastructure issues that's, you know, it ended up getting injected, and you covered a lot of it during the 2017 campaign, but the issue goes way back to 2011, 2012, when you were at the Herald. You covered it for the Herald. You've been covering it for McLean's and how it got injected into the municipal campaign, which was quite interesting. And that's the arena conversation. So what's your take on, you know, that in relationship to the Olympics and the history of, and sort of the political dynamic that was the arena discussion during the 2017 election?
This goes back to something I was saying earlier, that Nenshi is not like a lot of other mayors, where they get behind major, expensive, pro-business infrastructure projects. A traditional mayor, and we've seen this elsewhere, would be championing the development of a new convention center, saying we can't fall behind the convention center abilities of other cities. We need this as something that will build our city. Nenshi, unlike other mayors in other cities, said, no, I don't see why we need this. We have our convention center is fine. We have other things to spend money on for the general public, libraries, rec centers, transit, you name it. And people will come here because of Mountainsmen, because we have a giant energy industry. We don't need whether we have hosting capacity. That's fine. We have other ways to fill up our hotels restaurants in Calgary, and really other cities do too, but they get so seduced by the idea that convention centers are the holy grail of business. The same thing went with the arena. You saw in Edmonton and in other cities often, you have mayors championing, you know, becoming partners with the pro sports organizations who say, we need to be a partner. You're very valuable to our city. You define our city, and we need to build you a facility because that'll bring in restaurant business and that'll bring great concerts. Nenshi has been skeptical of that in a way a lot of senior politicians aren't. He was, do we need that? can't you guys pay for this? He said that in chippy ways that you wouldn't see others say that. Very much the tone and the style. I mean, a lot's been said about how Nenshi is different from politicians on that and how that is a benefit in some ways and a detriment because he tends to create rivalries that you wouldn't see another mayor create often. That's been a big one. And I think that the arena proponents, the Flames organization, Ken King and co, assumed that Nenshi and the mayor's office and the city council would be a partner, would be a traditional, Edmonton Oilers style partner and champion for this project, saying, yes, we will. Sure. Take our money. Yes, you're a partner. We will own this arena. We will give you what you want. And to council's great benefit, they largely agreed with Nenshi. Nenshi made a very, very pointed, rational argument as to why we shouldn't be the traditional old city backslapping partners. And council, and this has now happened with two successive councils, has largely agreed with him. I mean, there are some now on council who are saying, you know, maybe he shouldn't be the lead on this. Maybe we need to take a broader approach and a more conciliatory approach. I think there's a deal to be made. I think that both sides realize that. I think some of the characters in it, including Nenshi, including King, haven't become very conducive to creating a good partnership. The city will give up more than it wants. The Flames organization will give up more than it wants. And that's how negotiations work. The Flames really screwed up because they seem to think that their deal would be the deal. But we're not Edmonton for a bunch of reasons.
That's great. Well, one of the more national level stories you've done to a lot of acclaim was the story about, and actually quite early on when we were having the story about people border crossing, seeking refuge in Canada. How did that story come together? Tell us a little bit about that, because that's been, you know, a real hallmark for you in your time at McLean's.
Thanks. It's a story I've really become very passionate about telling. An editor who's from Manitoba had seen articles in local press about a rather harrowing case of a couple of Ghanaian men walking across the border from Minnesota into southern Manitoba at Emerson, Manitoba, and they suffered severe frostbite and lost their fingers. And I was talking about that this was happening more than it used to. And so my editor said, look into this and see if you can talk to some people. And I found a series of lawyers and refugees and refugee claimants, people who were hoping to get to convince judges or officials that they had legitimate cases of refugees. I was talked to several of them and unpacked why this was happening, why this was happening more after Trump, why Trump was a major catalyst, why Canada's own system had advantages that people would take advantage of and provide them hope, and how this was the last chance for people after a long number of attempts to find safety from persecution in their home country. When I wrote that piece, this was in January 2017, right before the Muslim ban, actually, or Trump's travel ban on majority Muslim countries, I had a sense it was going to go up. This was going to be an increasing issue. I didn't know how major an issue that was. But that first story, that was the first major national story on this situation. And it really drew attention internationally. After I had this story, there were people flying in from Britain, from New York, to cover this, to tell this story. And then we started seeing more and more people crossing in Quebec, which is now the epicenter of the situation. It's a very complicated crisis, certainly a phenomenon that Canada hasn't had at this level in history, that people were using this sort of loophole of the Safe Third Country Agreement to walk across the border and get arrested and seek asylum. It attracts a lot of prejudice, and that's really unfortunate. People think, oh, they're illegals, they don't belong here, they should wait their turn. This isn't how our system has ever worked. All countries have an option to seek asylum. If you're desperate enough to fly to a country and throw yourself at the mercy of the government, saying, I need protection. I am a refugee. I want into the system. I want to be a legal refugee. These people are all coming here to become legal refugees and legal residents of Canada. There are complicated reasons behind it. There are challenges. There are problems. This has not been an easy thing for the government, both politically or administratively. There's a huge backlog. This is not the way things should be. I've been trying over several stories to make sure help people understand it and why some of the prejudicial beliefs and arguments are really misguided and kind of wrong and on the spirit of the immigration culture and tradition and history that Canada has.
Well, Jason, thanks very much for coming. Keep up the great work with Maclean's. We need more hardworking journalists like yourself to keep uncovering the stories and lending perspective to what the city and this province is about. So thanks very much for coming.
You're welcome. I have a lot of fun and I really enjoy still being part of Calgary's conversation at the same time as being in a national magazine. And it's a joy to do that both on Twitter and in venues like this. So thanks.
Common Ground YYC is a production of Livewire Calgary. If you value quality local journalism, please consider supporting Livewire by following it on social media, by clicking and reading stories, advertising, or contributing directly via Patreon. Visit livewirecalgary.com.